Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. When it comes to new cancer treatments, the world seems somewhat numb to the idea that maybe there's a silver bullet on the horizon, light at the end of the tunnel, because of so many overly optimistic expectations that have not panned out, and also because of hundreds of outright bogus claims of cancer cures. So recently, CBS News was interviewing a scientist, a Dr. Michael Grossbard, with the Perlmutter Cancer Center on a new treatment where they target our own immune cells to go after cancer cells. And this is what Dr. Grossbard said. Oncologists are reluctant to use the word extraordinary, but these results are extraordinary. These are really remarkable findings that have a significant response for patients. And you want to talk about significant. In this study, U.S. researchers genetically modified T cells, it's part of our immune system, a type of white blood cell, in 35 terminally ill patients with leukemia. And these were people with advanced stage cancer. 94% went into remission. And this is just the latest and one of the larger of studies with this approach, this type of new cancer therapy. So to help us understand this and really the biology behind this, we're going back to our expert on antibody mutations, and that is Jonathan Bartlett. Jonathan, welcome back to Real Science Radio.
Well, Bob, thanks so much for having me on. It's always a pleasure. It's actually really exciting because most weeks I spend listening to your show.
Oh.
So it's really exciting to actually get to be on it, everyone.
Well, what an honor. Jonathan, for those who did not hear that show, I encourage them to go back 4 years ago in March 2012, and you are the founder of the Blythe Institute. Now, you are a layman, but after the passing, tragically, the passing of your two young children, you have spent years researching the nature of mutations to understand genetic disease and other things. And so you helped us understand some of what's going on when our body, the name of that show was Good Mutations Occurring on Demand and the Frequent Beneficial Targeting of Antibody Mutations. So could you help us? Let's do a refresher course on this.
The way I got into this is I had two children that had genetic diseases, and they both did eventually die. Mm. But I spent the years while they were alive studying genetics night and day. And that's kind of what we did in hopes that we could do something. After they died, I spent all this time researching genetics. What should I do with it? And I think the Lord kind of led me into the creation-evolution debate. I started researching more and more the way genetics work and the way mutation works. And I found out that it's kind of like bacteria, when it was first discovered, they thought it was all bad because every time the way that they found bacteria was that they found diseases and they found bacteria that were associated with them. Mm. And so it was kind of assumed that bacteria was always bad.
Well, and under a microscope, some of them, they look a little creepy, these microbes. And you think, here are these living organisms inside my body. Ah, this is a nightmare.
Yeah, but it turns out that like 99.98% of bacteria are actually good for you.
Wow.
And so it was just that we couldn't see them until they caused problems. Mm. And mutations are like that too. The reason why the mutations we're familiar with are all degenerative is because that's how we can see them. We wouldn't have really known about them except for the fact that they were causing problems.
In other words, we look at people who are suffering from a certain disease, and once we began to be able to sequence a genome, we look at the genes for certain proteins and we see a mutation and we realize, wow, there was a copy error when that person was conceived in the womb. There was a copying error in his genome and part of his DNA, and so he or she ended up with this disease. So that's one of the ways we first found these mutations.
Yes. And then on top of that, we've later found out that a lot of these mutations actually happen, are generated by the cell in order to accomplish purposes. And so the cell can actually remanufacture some of its genes in a more beneficial format. If you've never been exposed to a certain disease and you don't have the right antibodies for it, your body can actually go and mutate an antibody to make a new one to target the new disease. It's a pretty amazing process.
Okay, now we're going to have to explain that a bit more, because normally we hear about random mutations and that they're typically neutral or harmful. But you're talking about mutations that are sort of mutations on demand, where the cell is intentionally changing some of its coding.
Yes.
Or maybe some of the sort of targeting apparatus of an antibody, so that that antibody could then seek out and destroy a new harmful microbe that maybe your body has never encountered before.
The way that it works is that when we think about random mutations, as you said, these are not random. And that's why when we have the idea of mutation, we think about things that break. Well, these are intentional mutations. So your body does them on purpose. In fact, you know, when we think about mutations, we think about something happening randomly somewhere and not in, in a particular location. But these mutations happen not only on the right gene, but they happen in the right location of the right gene. Because half of the gene is used to stick to the bad stuff. The other half of the gene is used to signal to the rest of the body to say, hey, it's over here. Right.
So the other half, I think you called that the constant region.
That's right.
And these two halves, if I recall, they're like 500 base pairs or DNA letters long. Is that about right? Do you recall?
That's about right.
And so you have about 1,000 base pairs, maybe a little longer. Half of these instructions are constant, but the other half changes and there's frequent mutations. Now, when you talk about mutations to better target, let's say, a microbe, a germ, let's discuss that for a moment. In our body, proteins are three-dimensional. They could look like little machines, even. They could. And our cells are all three-dimensional. And so if you have a microbe that's causing you trouble and our body is trying to attack it with an antibody, well, if it will attach effectively to the germ, then it might be able to do damage to the germ. Maybe it'll even just stop the germ from reproducing. It's like a targeted weapon in the military. You might want a heat-seeking missile that'll target heat, or you might want a GPS-targeted missile to target a latitude, longitude. So in the human body, as with other species, part of our white blood cell immune system is the targeting mechanism that looks to seek and destroy. And you're saying that part has to find many different kinds of invaders, of germs, and so that part can constantly mutate so that it could seek and destroy this new intruder.
Exactly. And by keeping the constant region constant, it's able to provide continuity with the rest of the immune system. Because if it was changing the constant region, it would not know what to do with the antigen when it attached.
So the whole system would get confused. It would lose its place.
It wouldn't
actually know what it had just accomplished. If you send out these antibodies to attack this new intruder and they find it and they even destroy, you know, a few cells of it, but then that's it. But because there's a constant region, it's able to send information back to the greater immune system itself and say, hey, this targeting, this works. These instructions, this will stop that intruder. So take this, and we need a lot of these. And by a lot, I mean, it could be that your body is going to make millions, right, of these targeted
Absolutely.
Antibodies.
The other part of that is to recognize that in order for this whole system to work, the cell has to be able to put mutations in the right place. Because if they go in the wrong place, the whole thing breaks down. Mm. And so the cell has safeguards all around to make sure that when it turns on the mutation system, only the targeting part gets changed. None of the rest of it gets changed.
We're talking about, I used the term the base pairs earlier. If you think of the DNA molecule, it's called the double helix. It's like a spiral staircase that keeps spiraling through thousands of stories in a skyscraper. And it has rungs on that ladder, and there are 3 billion rungs, 3 billion. And so out of those 3 billion, you have about 1,000 of those rungs on the ladder, and half of those need to remain constant, and the other half need to be mutated so that you could seek and destroy this new microbe. That is wildly sophisticated, wildly complex.
And it's amazing because if you tried to presuppose that it happened by chance, then you'd have to say that a happenstance system developed a tightly regulated system.
Right.
And it just doesn't seem plausible.
Not only does it not seem plausible, I think we could effectively make the argument that it is impossible, because there's some symbolic logic going on here. There is targeting to find some enemy, and then there's a message that has to get back to say, hey, here's the right coding. Here's the right symbolic information to stop this threat, to overcome this threat. And all that is conceptual. And the laws of physics and the laws of chemistry, they don't have any symbolic logic functions. They just don't. The information on a DNA molecule, that information is symbolic. It's then used and implemented with these molecular processes, these subcellular processes. The information is implemented, but it's encoded in a symbolic way. So it's encoded and then it's decoded. So there are no tools in the secular reductionist evolutionist toolbox. There are no tools to solve this problem.
What's also cool is that for this new therapy, the scientists are working the same basic model that your cell uses. They're just performing it outside of your body. Previously, we were talking about antibodies. In this case, we have a very similar type of structure. It's called a T-cell receptor. Mm. The T-cell receptors, the way that they're working is they're pulling T-cells out of your body, and then they're replacing the variable region.
So these are the scientists.
Receptors have a constant region and a variable region, like antibodies.
When you said they're pulling out of your body, you're saying the scientists are removing T cells from the patient's body, and then what do they do?
So then they modify the variable region of the T cell receptors. Those have a constant region and a variable region as well, and the scientists, just like our bodies, have to keep that constant region the same so that it performs the task they want it to.
Because let's say
variable region so that it'll find the cancer cells.
Let's say they modify 10,000 T cells, let's say, and they inject them back into the patient. Well, if they keep the constant region constant, which they would do by design, this is all intelligent design, that will alert the rest of your immune system to the need to reproduce this kind of weapon. And so then your body takes over and it starts producing these in large quantities, large numbers. And they have found out, they've been working on this concept. There was another trial in Italy. They found out that when they put mutated T cells back into a patient's body, it's now been 14 years and the body still remembers that recipe, that instruction. So if that patient gets reinfected with the same organism, his immune system is right away ready to knock it out. So this is not just the cells that they're introducing in our body that are now taking on these cancer cells. This is our body learning. They're sort of teaching us at a molecular level how to fight this particular kind of cancer.
And what's exciting is they're expanding the number of cancers that this can treat as well.
Yeah, Jonathan, because cancer is the uncontrollable growth of abnormal cells. So if there is breast cancer or colon cancer, or a blood cancer, leukemia. Well, these are the uncontrollable growths of different types of cells. And a problem with cancer is that because these are our own cells that are growing now out of control, our immune system doesn't recognize them as a threat because they're our own cells. So the scientists are taking our immune cell, these T cells, and they're targeting them so that they will recognize our cancer cells as a threat. And so they're simply adjusting the targeting mechanism, and then they're allowing God's system to take its course.
What's amazing is that, you know, you said allowing God's system to take its course. It reminds me of the fact that, you know, we think modern medicine is great, and it is, but there's nothing in modern medicine that even comes close to what our immune system does on a day-in and day-out basis. Every day your body is fighting. Even in normal humans, we have cancer cells that are created, but our immune system is usually able to take them out. We have bacteria that enter in, but we have our immune system that takes it out. You know, within our own body, we have one of the most amazing, miraculous medical facility ever invented.
Oh, yeah. Just like the liver is a chemical plant beyond our ability to comprehend how it was architected. Jonathan, could we talk about the response of the evolutionist to all this information? Because the true believers and the high priest of Darwinism, like Richard Dawkins or Jerry Coyne or P.Z. Myers, these guys, they don't acknowledge. I mean, the last time they said, hey, that's a good point to a creationist was never. So we're not going to look to them to find out where is the state of the art in the mindset of molecular biologists regarding evolution and intelligent design. But we have done a show, Scholars Doubting Darwin, where we show that there are hundreds of thousands of advanced degreed specialists, scientists, PhDs, master degrees, medical doctors here in this country, in the U.S., who are doubting Darwin, who believe that God had to be involved in the origin of human life. We're talking hundreds of thousands, and we know this because of surveys and studies by secular leading evolutionary institutions, highly respected in the secular world. And we know this also because we have assembled the names of thousands of PhDs who are on record publicly opposing evolution. So when these discoveries are made about how the cell functions, and we're still only at the tip of the iceberg in understanding biology, the way God made us, and the way he made all the species of life on Earth, there are scientists by the thousands, by the tens of thousands, it seems like by the hundreds of thousands, who are recognizing that no secular explanation has ever come close to providing an origin for molecular biology. This stuff is all brilliant and sophisticated beyond measure.
Recently, there was a guy named Dr. James Tours who did a lecture that's on YouTube on just the very things you were talking about earlier with the impossibility of bringing these things into existence by happenstance. Dr. Tours is one of the most preeminent nanotechnology builders. He builds nanomachines.
He builds molecules for a living.
Yes. And so he goes through and he shows just the total implausibility of every system that anyone has ever proposed. And it is striking. He refuses to say whether, I don't know what his personal beliefs are, and he doesn't say that he believes that God had done it, but he shows that everything that we've ever tried to do to explain it falls not just short, but woefully short. I mean, ridiculously short.
Right. There's never been even a beginning of an answer to how a DNA molecule could describe a protein. There's never been even the beginning of an answer. We went to Oxford this fall to do research for a debate, real fun debate we had at kgov.com just search for Oxford, you'll find it. But while we were there, Will Duffy, my former producer, and I, we decided to go to New College, which is where Richard Dawkins is on the faculty, to give to him our Dawkins 3-to-1 evolution challenge, the genetic challenge. And he was not there, but we were able to put a printout of this. It's just a beautiful large postcard in his faculty mailbox. So we're pretty confident that he got it. No response yet so far. But this challenge, just go to rsr.org/Dawkins and you'll see it. The challenge is, could you give us just a rudimentary explanation, an algorithm, based on your lifetime, a career of promoting Darwinism? How could three letters or rungs on a DNA ladder begin to symbolize a single amino acid for building a protein? Just that. Not all the wild complexity, none of that. Just how do you, biochemically, how do you begin the representation, the symbolism, the symbolic logic that three letters on the DNA ladder will symbolize, will indicate one amino acid? How do you do that? The 3-to-1 challenge. And we assert that there is no conceivable answer. They will never be able to answer even that little part of a challenge to a biogenesis, life from non-life.
So Bob, you were asking me earlier about what other people say to this sort of thing. Because, you know, they never tell creationists, oh, you have a good point there. What's really interesting is that all of these points have been well conceded by the evolutionists. I did a talk on this. You can find it on YouTube. And I think you linked to it on your site as well.
Yeah, I do. And we'll relink to it. We'll embed your talk. Yes.
Dr. Larry Moran, who has a blog called Sandwalk, who's a vehement anti-ID guy and anti-creationist. One of the things he noted, he disagrees with my conclusions, but he noted that I presented the biology correctly. What I've found is that it is beyond arguable that this is targeted, but evolutionists won't use the word targeted. They will agree that the mutations don't happen in 99.99, I forget how many nines it is. It's 5 or 6 nines percent of the base pairs are skipped over, and only like the 0.0002% of them that are relevant are modified. But they won't call that targeting.
Targeting, of course. Let me give a quote from an Oxford biology professor who, by the way, rejects neo-Darwinism, Darwin's theory. He rejects it. And this is in 2013. This British biology professor, Oxford University's Dr. Dennis Noble, he was arguing against neo-Darwinism in a science journal, the Journal of Experimental Physiology. And this is of great significance, partly because Noble, he remains an evolutionist. But nonetheless, he acknowledges, quote, that all the central assumptions of the modern synthesis, often called neo-Darwinism, have been disproved. All of the main claims, all of the central claims of Darwinism have been disproved. And then I'm sure you know about, Jonathan, the famed atheist professor Thomas Nagel, who recently wrote a book titled Mind and Cosmos, Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False. And by the way, you can find all that at rsr.org/doubt for our scholars doubting Darwin.
So what's really interesting, what you just said about Nagel, how the materialist conception of the universe is almost entirely false. There's been a predisposition in science against non-materialist explanations. And just this past week, I hosted a conference, a variety of academics, that examined the role of the assumption of materialism in science and in other academic studies. And we looked at alternative ways of doing science and alternative ways of doing research, methodologies to use, really practical stuff about how people can explore God's creation without assuming materialism. And so we looked at a lot of different ideas, different mathematical ways of modeling nature.
Wow.
We looked at different ways of conceptualizing nature. and just looking at all the different possibilities that we could do, because even the atheists now are admitting that materialism is a false philosophy. That means we need to rethink the way that we're going to do science so that it doesn't carry with it this presumption of materialism, no, is false.
That they're groping in the dark. And we're speaking with Jonathan Bartlett of the Blythe Institute. Jonathan, they pretend that their materialism is a conclusion of their scientific investigation. That's a lie. Their materialism is a presupposition that they bring. Their rejection of God as the creator, they're presuming that to start with, and then Richard Dawkins, Stephen Hawking, and so on, they pretend to the public that they've arrived at this position scientifically, and that's simply not true. You and I, last time you were on, we're about out of time. We talked about the irony of the evolutionists when they look at targeted mutations happening in our antibodies, where half of the system is variable, the variable region, the other half is the constant region. And so there are these targeted mutations. And so they refuse even to admit that these mutations are not happening randomly, that they must be happening intentionally, that they're being targeted. They refuse even to admit that because they recognize that their entire worldview is hanging by a thread. And at any moment, from any perspective, that thread will break. And so when we see these incredibly rapid mutations happening right where we need them to happen so that we could remain healthy, they say, well, that's just random chance that those mutations are happening there. That shows their cowardice. They are afraid of their own shadow. No, they're afraid of their own immune system.
Well, it just amazes me the kind of wordsmithing that it takes to get around the obvious facts of biology. And you have biologists trying to get around the basics of biology to promote their worldview. It just goes to show who's doing the science and who's trying to avoid it.
Well, thank you so very much, Jonathan Bartlett. We will link to your website and we'll embed your YouTube presentation. Thank you so much for joining us again. What an honor.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
You're very welcome. Okay, so Jonathan Bartlett. And by the way, based on Jonathan's last comment, Richard Dawkins has said that biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. In fact, he wrote that in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, which I read back in the 1980s. Stephen Hawking, the world's most famous physicist atheist, says that the universe looks like it's fine-tuned. The world's most famous biologist, atheist, Richard Dawkins, says biology looks like it was all designed. And here they are wondering, well, if there's a God, why didn't he show us any evidence of himself? It is everywhere they look. Everywhere they look. That is our Lord. That is our God, our Creator, Jesus Christ, God the Son who made us. This is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in.